Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Discovering God's Future for Your Church. This turnkey video toolkit helps your congregation discern and implement God's vision for your church's next faithful steps. Discovering God's Future for Your Church is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. How can the church be more receptive and open as neighborhoods become more complex and culture more multifaceted? In this episode, we speak with consultant Paul Nixon, who works to help churches meet the demands of a rapidly changing age.
I'm Ann Michael. I'm Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership, and I'm host of this Leading Ideas Talks podcast. And I'm pleased to be talking today with Paul Nixon, who is the Director of Church Multiplication for the United Methodist Church, and he's also the head of the Epicenter Group, where he and his colleagues have coached or consulted with about 1,000 churches in North America and Europe, working with a lot with mergers and new church starts and multi-site initiatives. Paul is the author of a number of books, and his most recent book is Multi, the Chemistry of Church Diversity. So I'm so glad to have you talking with us today, Paul.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Yeah. So before we turn to the specifics of your book, I kind of wanted to put a broader frame around our conversation because I sense in this book, as well as some of your previous books, that because of your work with church planters and new church starts and other leaders who are kind of at the green growing edges of the church, I think you really are a trend spotter. And I wanted to know what you're seeing today that's different than maybe a few years ago, or what are you really paying attention to as you sort of survey the landscape of what's going on with churches?
In terms of what was driving into this book, the thing that I was noting was the increasing complexity of neighborhood that surrounds churches. In the North American context, and certainly I work in the UK, it's similar there, what we see is less homogeneity by zip code, by census block group. I mean, it's just used to all of the Italians lived over here and the Irish over here and the African American working class and so forth. We were all sort of segregated. That really is mixing up more and more, especially with gentrification of cities and so forth. What it means is that any church that has been around more than 40 years has seen massive changes in the neighborhood. They were once upon a time planted in a neighborhood they probably understood, and they designed ministry and message with that made sense in that setting. That really has changed. And so we're sensing that there is a readiness on the part of many church leaders to really navigate a more multi-approach to the way they do church. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the shifts that's happening. You know, MLK Jr. said about 50 years ago, he said 11 o'clock is still the most segregated hour of the week.
Right.
Well, it's probably still is, and we can talk about that in a moment, but that is definitely changing, and that's going to change, I believe, radically in the next quarter century.
So you do think that the churches will become more diverse than they are now?
Oh, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
And I think it has something to do with the capacity of people and the other life experiences they bring. People are, especially the younger they get, the more so. But people, whether they've been in the military or they've worked in industry, they just public schools, they have lived in a more multi-world than their grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And that is equipping them, and they're marrying across all these cultural lines as well. That's equipping them not only to be ready to do multi in the church life, but really to want it.
Mm-hmm. I was intrigued in your book. You talked a lot about sort of the multi-site revolution of the past 25 years, and that maybe that was giving way to some different patterns now. Where do you see that headed?
The multi-site revolution is an interesting thing. That's what got me on this project, and then the more I looked at it, the more I realized that the bigger revolution was not multi-site, but was the whole multi-thing. But in terms of multi-site, I was a pastor in one of the early multi-site churches late in the 20th century, and we thought at that time that this was a way for large congregations that were overflowing their space to find space to keep moving without having to either relocate or go into a gigantic capital campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still true.
Right.
But more and more of what we see with multi-site is not the large church that is overflowing to another large space, but it's the mid-sized church. It's the dinner church that it's having dinner in two locations and would
right.
like to do, has a group that live over in another part of town. Or the church that has adopted a struggling congregation and now they are functioning as one congregation in two sites.
Mm-hmm.
But neither of them would have been the kind of church we would have thought about doing multi-site 20 years ago.
So it's not a facility usage question. It's more of a strategy for connecting and outreach.
Yes, very
yeah.
much so.
So when I picked up the book Multi, my thought on reading the title was it was going to be another book on multicultural and multi-ethnic ministry. And I think what really surprised me about it is that it's so much more. I mean, you're talking about a church's capacity to embrace difference and change in any number of different ways, whether it's different generations, different theological perspectives, across different locations. So can you define, you use the concept of a multi-church. Can you define what a multi-church is in your way of thinking?
It really is a church that is taking different cultures and helping to bond them together. And I think culture is the right word, although I don't really use the word that much in the book as I've reflected on the book. I think the word culture is a word I might have used more. You can have generational culture. People, they speak the same language, they grew up in the same community, but the culture of the teenagers is significantly different than the culture of the grandparents. So you can have generational culture, you can have culture that revolves around language, around nations of origin, and so forth and so on. I think the way we're using multi is different culture. And of course, what we see in the United States right now is political cultures and worldview are very, very different. And it may not involve language, it may not involve significant ethnicity in terms of difference, but the cultural challenges are quite significant.
Right. So you address transcending different theological worldviews, different liturgical traditions, different linguistic traditions, different generations. And I think, if I'm reading it right, that the thesis of your book is that across any one of these dimensions of diversity that a congregation may wish to engage, there are some sort of basic capacities and characteristics that allow a congregation to be in a position to be able to transcend some of those differences. Can you identify what some of those capacities and characteristics are that make a church more capable of opening itself to these different kinds of differences?
Well, I think it's a capacity for listening. Listening to a person's story is the most basic capacity. It's not hard to learn, but we do have to slow ourselves down, and sometimes we have to check our defensive, reflexive thoughts that are going through our mind and realize that for the sake of this person, this child of God that I'm talking to, strange as they may be to my experience, I want to turn all of that stuff off in my brain, and I really just want to hear, where are they coming from?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the most basic capacity, is to pay attention to that. I think there's also the capacity to, in a group setting, to lean in toward the person who's having the hardest time articulating their mm-hmm. story or their thought or their point of view. And often when you're doing group work, and we do that at church, especially around leader teams, worship mm-hmm. planning teams, ministry design teams. There are certain people who, because of their life experience, they may be, as I am, they may be white, male, and relatively well-educated, and that tends to give us an easy, our mouths open easily to share our thoughts. And we can take up airtime. And there may be others, we may need to recognize as a team that there's others that we need to stop and we really need to be still and to listen and be sure that their perspectives are being heard and being honored mm-hmm. as well. I do believe that the group life of a leader team becomes the laboratory where we work out how you do multi on a larger level. Mm-hmm. And if a team can work it out and can move through some of the pinch points and the discomfort and the hurt feelings and the awkwardness, mm-hmm. they can lead a church to move through those same experiences on a larger scale.
Yeah. I really took encouragement from your book in the sense that you seem to be saying that any church can take a step.
Yes.
You know, toward, in this direction, and that you don't need to tackle it all at once. I mean, you can decide on one of these aspects of diversity that is the most important that you want to pursue and concentrate your effort there.
That's really a principle of the way that I do consulting, and I think it's also a basic to what we believe theologically, that wherever you are, whatever your GPS is, wherever you find yourself, both in terms of your institutional health or your capacities, it's where you are, and God meets you there, mm-hmm. and then there are faithful steps. There are good next steps from there. And I've tried to tell churches, especially churches that are struggling or maybe kind of late in their life cycle or needing a major revisioning, it's okay. We're here. We've celebrated some wonderful past, but we're here. And this is a good place. Mm-hmm. And God is with us here. And there's faithful things we can do from here.
Do you think that there's always going to be a niche for a congregation that caters to some specific demographic? Because I mean, I see that trend too. I mean, all these, you know, the divergent church of these churches that are around specific affinities or a lot of the things described in your book, Weird Church, they're very sort of niche experiments.
Would be yes, especially smaller specialized congregations. Uh-huh. Yes, there is going to be a room for niche. I think the most obvious place that we've seen it over the many years, and we'll see it in the future, is with immigrant congregations,
right,
where you have a group of people that are coming from a very similar kind of experience, and that's a niche. But even in the other, what were kind of niche congregations, there is more complexity now that's brought even into the niche
right.
congregations. People are listening to many more podcasts, and they're on different TV channels and different stations. So there's a lot of difference that's coming even to what before would have been a very, very simple and rather homogeneous group of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the important subtexts that runs throughout your book is the idea that as churches become more diverse along any number of different dimensions, it's still important that the church have a unifying principle, and there's a coherent identity and core narrative that's holding it together. And I'm thinking maybe in a niche congregation that's built around arts or nature or these things that interest becomes the core principle, and then people can manifest all kinds of different diversities as long as they're interested in that particular expression of faith.
Agreed. I worked with a project here in the District of Columbia several years ago with deaf parents it was deaf children, and the parents, some of them were deaf, some of them were not, but the common interest was they wanted to give their children a faith community experience with other children, and they wanted it to be a friendly place for deaf children. So some of the siblings were deaf and some were not, but it was all around that. There were about 40 people. That was the unifying thing. That was definitely niche.
Yeah.
But if you got to know those folks, they were all over the spectrum in terms of religious background, ethnicity, theology.
Mm-hmm.
So it was there was also considerable diversity, even in that niche group.
Right. So for a more standard issue congregation that was looking to become more multi and increase its diversity, that idea of having to have a core narrative, a coherent identity to hold it together, what would be some of the ways that a congregation could create that unity amid diversity? I mean, it probably wouldn't be deaf parents or parents of deaf children, but I think maybe we're not as aware of some of the common things that hold us together, because we take it for granted in a homogeneous community, right?
Yes, we do. I think often it's a passion around a particular mission,
mm-hmm.
or a particular demographic for which we really long to serve and to be connected and to be in community with that demographic,
mm-hmm.
which could be a demographic that's suffering or a demographic that's just simply disconnected from faith community.
Mm-hmm.
But it could revolve around that. It could revolve around the way we worship and gather.
Mm-hmm.
That it's in a distinctive way that's maybe a little different than some of our neighbors. So it's going to have something to do with distinctives. And I tend to say these arise organically out of the life of the church. And often if we come together, we can name them and note them. Many churches that seem to be sort of floundering, if you were to get significant folk together in a fellowship hall in a circle on a Saturday afternoon, would begin to be able to name some of the things that make them distinctive, and which could range from from talents that are disproportionately contained in the congregation,
mm-hmm.
professional kinds of experience. I worked with a church that was just full of retired school teachers many, many years ago. We had a capacity for doing community children's ministry that just came from the latent experience. And those women did not want to teach Sunday school on Sunday morning.
Right. Yeah, I bet
But there was a gift there,
mm-hmm.
having all of those retired educators, and they had a blast, and we were able to do something quite significant.
Hmm. So I think the more deeply I got into your book, the more I realized that at some level it was really about change, about the church needing to change and sort of the direction in which the church needed to change. I think the part that I found most provocative was the quote you had from Diana Butler Bass, where she said that the church of the future is going to be on the internet.
Yeah, I about drove off the road when she said that on NPR that morning. And I thought, that is just, it was one of those things, I mean, she may not even remember saying it. It was just, you know, it was just one of those things you say. And yet the way it hit me was, there's so much more truth to that.
Yeah.
Because the way in which we interact, if we could, 20 years ago, we would not be able to imagine the way that we interact virtually.
Right.
And through the internet, we just couldn't imagine it. And to press that with technology, plus our increasing comfort with experiencing community, doing education and small group work that way, 20 years hence, it's just obvious to me that the church is going to be on the internet.
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought the points you made about how, you know, that's how people do so much of their work these days. If you're a student, that's how you do so much of your study. You know, if you're a younger adult, that's how you're meeting people. That's probably how you're going to get connected with the person you marry. I mean, if you can do all that important life work and relational work on the internet, why wouldn't that be,
yes.
you know, the place where the faith community would live? But I found that incredibly provocative. It made me think that, you know, the church that my grandchildren might go to is going to be entirely different from what my experience of church is, which is why I asked that question at the beginning about, you know, where Is that the biggest trend you see?
It will be different. That church of our grandparents, our grandchildren, is going to be different. And yet, I think if we were to be able to just zoom out 50 years and see it, we would also recognize the telltale traits of church in that new space in ways that would probably delight us.
Right. There's been so much more attention to churches with online worship and being hospitable to their online visitors and beginning to, you know, be more cognizant of the need to provide people the opportunity to give online. But that's all still built around our same basic framework.
Yes.
And you're talking about, you know, not just that we're going to take what we do and put it online, but that we're going that church will be designed in a totally different way to live in an online space.
We will see a lot of resources coming out helping us to get our minds and practice around that, I'm sure, in the next 20 years. I do believe that in the American context, we are so nimble about starting a ministry for anybody and everybody. And it's one of the reasons we've stayed relatively healthy in terms of church life in this country when many of our other many other Western countries have really struggled and seen major decline.
Right.
We're seeing our challenges now, but we've stayed ahead of the wave for at least half a century. And I think that's because of we were innovating to create a church for anybody and everybody, and often in a very niche sort of way. The shift from church being the most homogeneous unit of American community,
mm-hmm.
to the point that it can be hijacked by politicians, that we're probably seeing the end of that era. I do believe that churches are going to be intentionally much more diverse in the future, and that will include political diversity.
Hmm.
I'm almost certain of that. And with that political diversity, I think it becomes harder for us to be sort of harnessed by a candidate or by a particular political movement.
Hmm.
I do see us in a diverse church, it's harder to pull that off.
That's interesting to me because I've heard other observers of church life say that in small communities and rural communities where, you know, there's maybe one Lutheran church or one United Methodist church, people don't have a choice but to come together across their political differences. And so within one congregation, you may have red and blue, but that once you get into an urban context, people can self-select more easily.
They can, and in this era we do, but there are all kinds of reasons why we self-select. I think right now we're in an extremely polarized moment politically.
Right.
That may pass, but we also choose to come together for powerful worship.
Mm-hmm.
We choose to come together in order to expose our children to people with other kinds of stories. There's a lot of different motivations that pull people into a church or make a church a very special and magical kind of experience for them. And I think we're going to see more mixing. If there was anybody that I'd be paying attention to right now with regard to kind of where it's all going, I would be paying attention to young seminary graduates under the age of, say, 35,
mm-hmm.
And especially evangelicals, and look at how different they are than the 55 and 65-year-olds in terms of how they lead. Their instincts are very, very different, and I think are more embracing of diversity,
mm-hmm.
certainly.
Mm-hmm.
So thankfully, there's always a new generation coming behind us to kind of clean up the mess that we make.
Right. But I think I do think that one of the really positive messages of your book is that you know, churches don't have to go from 0 to 60 on this.
No.
That they can begin to work on, you know, one aspect of the multivalence that you describe. So if a church wanted to head down that road, what would be the steps that you would recommend that they take? How would they decide which dimension of diversity was important for them to tackle? And then how would they walk down that road?
I think it begins in a prayerful walk around the neighborhood, and I mean literally, but not just literally, but it's a, there has to be a contemplative space where we just get out of decision making and strategizing, and we just look around, mm-hmm. and we have some conversation, and we begin to assess both what are some of our gifts and capacities and assets that we have to offer, both in terms of people, facilities, whatever, and looking at our neighborhood, what are some of the possibilities for collaboration? Just what seems to be an easy beginning?
Mm-hmm. So it's contextual.
It's very contextual, and I say start small.
I think a lot of pastors are very cognizant of the need to be doing the kind of things that you're talking about. But a lot of the people in the pews are, you know, not just, it might not be what, how they see reality, or it's not where they're, you know, so how does a pastor or other leader in a congregation start to build some energy and awareness within a congregation about a need to go in a new direction like this?
Well, I've always begun with the idea that you don't pull out the rug from underneath the people that are already there, but that you begin with an honoring of the good that is in the mm-hmm. ministry that is there, and a respect for it. My mom is 82, and I think about her when I am working with congregations that have a perhaps a shrinking population that may be a little bit isolated from the neighbors. Her role as a layperson in her church, which went through a very compelling turnaround in inner city Dallas, her role as a layperson was to be a person that pointed to the positive when people were getting uncomfortable about the changes and the new people and all the shifting. And she continued over those decades to sit on the same row. She was always teaching her Bible class. And she was sort of a lay stabilizer. I think a few good lay folk in churches that have a good orientation to the fact that the church is not about us ultimately, but it's about God and what God wants to do in the neighborhood, can really be helpful to those who become, who lose their equilibrium over change. And often we're talking about folks that are later in life, and everything seems to be changing anyway. I mean, they're dealing with the death of a spouse, they're mm-hmm. losing some independence, and now the church is bringing all these new people in, and it's just more than they can take. And I think it takes great care to love people and to realize that most of these folks, in their best moment, and when they're not going through a sense of crisis themselves, would be for good change and for reaching and loving neighbors.
Yeah. No, I think you do have to kind of frame that, keep framing that for people, because in my church, I know there are people who, their attitude is, well, the church meets my needs.
Yes.
You know, and when you come to them with an idea for something new, that's the standard that they evaluate it by.
Yes.
And you know, if that's where a lot of people are in the church, I think it's hard for them to think more proactively about the possibility of the church being something different.
I'm reminded of a church in Oregon where we heard this kind of thing, and we said, well, at the rate we're going, we'll be turning out the lights, I want to say, in 2029. You know, we just kind mm-hmm. of ran the numbers and the trends. And to which the response was, so what?
I'll be dead by then, yeah.
I will have had a good run by then. This will have worked for me and for most of my friends.
Yeah.
So what?
Yeah.
And so then we had to deal with the so what. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important thing to deal with. We say the me generation is considerably younger, but I think all of us have a little bit of egocentric mm-hmm. you know, way that we go about life, and it's easy to especially when we are in a place of grieving all of the changes, to really make church a comfort zone and a therapeutic place of comfort and sort of getting ready for the next 7 days for ourselves. Church is more than that, and when churches are in the height of their energy and their world change, they're much more than that. And the funny thing is, I think most people are able, when gently confronted with that challenge, to stop and to realize, yeah, the church is more than that.
Yeah.
And often, the thought of the church being a blessing to the next generation, to people they don't even know yet, is really a lovely thing to think as you're approaching the end of your time on this planet, to think, I could have an investment.
Right.
Through the renewal of this place, in planting a tree that's going to give shade to a lot of
yeah.
other people.
But it may not be the renewal of this place.
It may not be the renewal of the place.
Because yes. I think in what you're saying, and it's a very hopeful message, but it may not be that every single local congregation continues in the same form that we know it. Most probably won't. And
right.
yet, you know, understanding that that doesn't mean that God is through with the church, and understanding that, you know, we still have a responsibility to see the Christian message continue to a new generation, but it may be in very different ways. I mean, I think encouraging people to think a little bit bigger about what our task is helpful as well. So to bring this to a close, what are you focusing on next? Is this diversity issue still really the place, or?
Oh, this is a place. This is something that I will be working on for years. I think it's a critical issue, and it's not like we're going to tackle this one and
no.
and ace it in 3 years, and we'll be on to the next challenge. This is a big, big piece, and so I expect to be working on this for the next 20 years. I mean, I really do think that helping churches navigate the shift to becoming intentionally more multivalent in their way of being is very important work, in whatever sense that is.
Well, I thank you for that commitment to this work, Paul, because it certainly helped me put a bigger frame around this issue of diversity and see how critical it is as the church changes, as it addresses a more and more complex future. So thanks so much for this work. Thanks for the book. Thanks for talking to us today. And I wish you luck in this.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we speak with Ronald Slaughter, pastor of St. James AME Church, who shares how he maintains important traditions while still innovating.
It was the inside, outside church, and outside in church. And the outside in church, of course, is that church that focuses more and is more concerned about the things outside of the church than they are about the things inside of the church, which means the outside in church is a part and focus on the community. And that's what we use to grow this church like it is at St. James. Social justice has helped this ministry to focus on things outside of the walls of this church that impacts the community. And what I've learned, Dr. Poe, if you take care of the people, they'll find their way to that church if they know that that church is willing to do more for people than it's willing to do for itself.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.